This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 16th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 422. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the Big Deal feature, in August, the BC Supreme Court decided in favor of Aboriginal title enrichment. In September, a judge confirmed Aboriginal title on Haida Gwaii. Where does that leave private property in British Columbia? Was it a mistake for the NDP to adopt the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People? Lawyer Jeffrey Moyse, who spent 31 years advising the BC government on Aboriginal law, returns to the podcast to explore these hot topics. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. In the fall of 2025, one of the biggest stories in British Columbia is how the courts and the EB-NDP government are handling First Nations land disputes. In August, after a decade-long legal battle, the Cowichan Nation won back 800 acres in Richmond. Some of it is privately owned. It's in an area where the Cowichan had a summer village until the 19th century. The case is being appealed. In September, the NDP government went to court to support the Haida Nation's successful application for title over Haida Gwaii. Questions about private property clouded the 10th BC Cabinet and First Nations leaders gathering at the beginning of November in the Vancouver Convention Centre. Here is Premier David Eby.
Yes, Premier, when the BC Treaty Commission was established by the NDP government in the 1990s, the minister of the day said, assured the legislature, private property will not be on the table. Is that still the provincial government's position?
Yes, in fact, well, here's the thing. Sometimes we buy private property on a willing seller, willing buyer basis as part of a negotiation with a First Nation. And so sometimes there is private property implicated in that way. But the best example I can point to is the Haida title recognition recently, where private property was carved out and in multiple sections of that agreement with the Haida, it was clear that the province of BC retains jurisdiction, that private property rights are protected and go forward, that only through a willing seller, willing buyer scenario could those private properties exchange hands, and that the Haida recognized that. We have not one, not two, but three modern treaties that are in ratification and voting, most recently Kitsamkalem, which voted to ratify that treaty, where again private property rights are protected, and we're ensuring that Indigenous rights are recognized at the same time as private property rights continue going forward. So we know we can do this. We have been doing this work. The court decision, I'll be blunt, is a wrench into that important work that's been happening. But I think it provides us an opportunity to both work with Cowichan to address their concerns going forward, I hope, but also to get clarity from the court going forward.
There's a lot of uncertainty here in British Columbia, and I thought the best person to talk to would be someone we had on the podcast last year during the election, someone who was very popular with listeners, Jeffrey Moyse. He's a former senior lawyer with the provincial government. He advised six BC governments on Aboriginal land use and other issues, and he's my guest now on the podcast. Jeffrey, welcome back to the Breaker.News podcast, and I want to start off with the big question first, the big question that's on a lot of people's minds. Private property in British Columbia, fee simple property transactions, does it still exist at this point? Where is it going?
On the question that you've asked first, private property is certainly thrown into some question in BC now as a result of the Cowichan judgment. My colleague Tom Isaac has been saying in a lot of interviews, and I think he's absolutely right, that the problem with the Cowichan judgment is really that the judge went beyond the scope of the case. The case was about an Aboriginal title finding in Richmond, and that's controversial enough. I understand that. But she went beyond that, and she said, she actually said that a precedent that follows from her judgment is essentially that the Land Title Act, which protects private property, it's what gives you your indefeasible property interest in your private land, is basically inapplicable wherever Aboriginal title is declared, as it was in Richmond, the whole of that 750-800 acre parcel. So she didn't just limit that to Richmond. She's basically said this is a precedent in BC where Aboriginal title is found. The protections in the Land Title Act, which basically, as I said, give you your private property right and make it indefeasible, will be wiped away, according to her. So the reason Tom and myself and others are sort of raising this issue is this is the real issue for us with this judgment, is it goes beyond Richmond and it purports to say things generally about private property and Aboriginal title in the rest of the province. So the other thing I would say about the Richmond judgment itself, people need to understand that Aboriginal title was declared by the court over that entire 750-800 acre piece of land. She did not go so far as to declare it over the other 1,000 acres, which the Cowichan had claimed. She demurred on that. She said, I only find it over 800 acres. But of course, in the appeal process, the Cowichan have now come out and said, well, we are appealing this as well. And in our appeal, we're going after the other 1,000 acres because we think the judge was wrong and we think she should have declared Aboriginal title to the entire 1,800 acres. So that will be in the appeal. The other thing that people need to know, there's a lot of confusion about defective and invalid. What this judge did is she said that the private properties owned by the City of Richmond and by Canada and the Port Authority on those lands, which she found to be subject to Aboriginal title, she went so far as to say that those private property interests are, she issued an extra declaration and she said they are, by the way, defective and invalid. And then she gave an 18-month reprieve for all of that to be worked out. So people need to know that that defective and invalid declaration applied only to those lands. It did not issue over the Richmond private properties. The Cowichan had not asked her to declare those properties defective and invalid, so she didn't. So be aware that in terms of the private property lands, there is no 18-month pause. She's basically said with the private lands, it's up to the province to go and negotiate a proper reconciliation with the Cowichan right away. So I think those are a couple of things people need to understand about the judgment.
So people should be watching very closely what the provincial government does in the months and years to come, because could this be applied elsewhere in the province? Could other First Nations go to court and ask for and achieve the same type of decision and put people's private property in question?
Yes, on the basis of the Cowichan judgment, they could. Challenge the private property interests. If a declaration of Aboriginal title issues from a court over those private lands, then what we know from her judgment, as long as it remains good law, and it is law today, what we know from her judgment is that the immediate effect of an Aboriginal title declaration over anybody's private property will be that the indefeasibility provisions that protect you under the Land Title Act have no application. So what have you got? You've got a fee simple which is thrown into question. The court hasn't gone so far as to declare it invalid, but what is it? It certainly is not protected, according to her, by the Land Title Act. So I'm not quite sure what you've got, but I'm pretty sure that it's diminished. That is an outcome anywhere Aboriginal title, if Aboriginal title were declared over private property today, her judgment stands for that proposition that the private title, it will not have the protection of the Land Title Act.
Should the province or the federal government, and maybe even Richmond itself, but should the governments that were part of this massive case that went on for years in BC Supreme Court, should they have approached it differently? Should they have argued differently and been more aggressive about this? Or is this a symptom of the official positions of the federal Liberal government and the provincial NDP government, essentially that they want to give land back?
Folks should know that this case, when it began under a BC Liberal government, as I recall. At the time, everybody, all the lawyers, were well aware that the Supreme Court of Canada in Delgamuukw in 1997 had basically said that provincial legislation, provincial crown grants, are not constitutionally competent to extinguish Aboriginal title. And they said that because of the division of powers. They said extinguishment of Aboriginal title is at the core of exclusive federal jurisdiction. Ergo, provinces have never had the ability to extinguish Aboriginal title themselves. They don't have the constitutional authority to do that. That judgment in Delgamuukw was well known to all the lawyers when this Couchin case was brought to court. So the issue for the lawyers was, well, do we go in and actually challenge the Supreme Court of Canada in this trial judgment, which seemed like an iffy proposition, or do we just stay silent on extinguishment and try and dream up or concoct, I suppose, I don't like that term, but to actually come up with a substantive legal argument that would not be unconstitutional for the province to argue. So they argued, and I think this has come out recently, so I'm not breaching any privilege here. They argued that the Aboriginal title was in effect suspended and displaced when a crown grant was issued by the province. So the notion being that once exclusive use and possession was given to a crown grantee by the province, the right of exclusive use and possession of the Aboriginal title holder was removed. It was set aside. It was, if you like, suspended. The difference between that and extinguishment is simply that in the province's argument, if the private land interest ever escheated to the crown, stopped being private land and became crown land again, the Aboriginal title claim would spring back into place over that crown land. So that's the difference between the province's argument and extinguishment. Now, of course, a lot of people have said, well, the EB government compounded that, surely, when they issued these directives, and the federal government issued directives as well. That was when Mr. EB, I think, was the Attorney General, they issued directives to litigators that they would not argue extinguishment under any circumstances. So that basically cemented the province's having to run with its suspension and displacement theory of validity for crown grants.
So we've also had a situation where the Haida went to court about Haida Gwaii, and the NDP government went there in support of them to basically go before a judge and get an order to not allow a future government to undo what the NDP have done with the Haida. Basically give the Haida more control over Haida Gwaii, the former Queen Charlotte Islands. That process has also caused a lot of consternation among citizens and a lot of questions about the governance of Haida Gwaii and the British Columbia relationship with the Haida. Is this a matter of just poor communication by the government, or did they take the wrong strategy?
I have a few things to say about Haida Gwaii, if I can. First of all, your listeners should know that the Haida rejected the treaty process some years ago. I think, I don't know, but I think on the basis that all it would yield for them is treaty settlement lands over portions of probably coastal Haida Gwaii and not title to any of the rest. They were not prepared for that to be an outcome, I think it's fair to say, is my understanding. So they basically walked away from the treaty process, I think, for that reason. Secondly, they entered into, well, they brought a court case like Cowichan, where they intended to prove their Aboriginal title to the entirety of Haida Gwaii. Now, in the Haida decision of 2004, which people may know as being the decision that gave us the duty to consult and accommodate as appropriate, there was quite a bit of evidence in front of the trial judge in that case. This wasn't an Aboriginal title case, but trial judge got to see a lot of evidence of Aboriginal title claims by the Haida. His conclusion was that within a kilometer of the shoreline, the Haida had a reasonable probability of establishing Aboriginal title. Beyond a kilometer from the shoreline, he said that was just a reasonable possibility. So we have a trial judge looking at evidence, and he said he looked at voluminous evidence, saying, I'm not so sure about this claim being successful more than a kilometer from the shore. Now, everybody has ignored that part of the 2004 Haida process. And of course, the Supreme Court of Canada didn't comment on it because they were trying to work out at the time, how do you prevent the province or Canada from destroying Aboriginal title claimed lands before the claims are proven in court. So we have that. Then we have, and so the Haida are in court. They are bringing evidence for their 100% claim to Haida Gwaii. And then at some point, well, at various points, negotiations started to take place between the Haida and the province and between the Haida and the federal government. So we're not talking three-party negotiation here. We're talking two bilateral negotiations, one with each senior government. Why is that significant? Because I think the Haida wanted to make sure that those agreements did not get characterized to be a treaty under Section 35 sub 3 of the Constitution Act. So I think they purposely ensured that they did double bilateral agreements. The provincial agreement, of course, went on, as you know, it's the Rising Tide Agreement. People can Google it. It went on to basically say the Haida have Aboriginal title to the entirety of Haida Gwaii, seabed, surrounding waters, the entirety of the Haida Gwaii archipelago. My view has always been, based on the, at least on the trial judgment in the other Haida case, where did that come from? Where did 100% of Haida Gwaii? We're talking about a million hectares of land that the province walked in and said, yep, we're okay with that being your Aboriginal title. Well, the test for Aboriginal title is occupation, not just exclusivity. And I have some real questions about whether that test could have been met in the trial. So in essence, the Haida managed to negotiate their way out of their trial, or part of it, the part of it that dealt with Aboriginal title. The trial is still live, which means that I assume that the Haida can come back and say, we want damages now for everything the province has ever done to the whole of the Haida Gwaii archipelago. So there are some problems with Haida at the outset, but one I wanted to flag for you, which I think the provincial government completely missed. Remember that the decision in Cowichan came out on August the 7th. Almost a month later, short of 2 days, on September the 5th, the Haida went into court to get their declaration of title to the whole of Haida Gwaii, including the private lands. Now, that's a month after the judge in Cowichan said, if an Aboriginal title declaration issues over private lands, what the Haida have just managed to do, the Land Act, the Land Title Act doesn't apply. And so suddenly, without their knowledge or participation, all the private landowners on Haida Gwaii now have I won't call it a defective title, but they have something less than they had before, because the logic is sections 23 and 25 of the Land Title Act don't apply to those lands anymore as a result of Cowichan. So my question to the government would be, who was asleep at the switch? Because they went in with the Haida to achieve this declaration, which they should have known by that time would basically take away the statutory protections for private lands on Haida Gwaii. The other thing that's important, and then I'll stop. The other thing that's important to know is that the so-called continuation of provincial jurisdiction over Haida Aboriginal title lands is only confirmed in an agreement with the Haida. There's no legislation that says provincial jurisdiction continues. It's only agreed to by the Haida. The second thing is that the other thing that's only agreed to by the Haida is that the fee simple interests will not be challenged by the Haida. So I think what we've got on Haida Gwaii for private lands, I think, if I'm right, we have private land interests which have now been essentially diminished, do not have the protection of the Land Title Act, and are there at the pleasure of the Haida. Now, when Premier Eby says this is the deal, this is the real deal that solves all of these problems in BC, I'll ask people who are listening to think about that very carefully.
We're in 2025, 2026 is just around the corner, but rewind to 1993, the BC Treaty Commission process was set up. The provincial government, the federal government were going to negotiate with each of the First Nations. They're going to negotiate. They weren't going to litigate. They were going to negotiate settlements. The First Nations were going to get land, money. They're going to get self-government. They're going to get out from under the Indian Act. There are First Nations that describe the Indian Act as racist legislation, and they wish it be struck down. But here was a chance for First Nations to leave the Indian Act, to have self-government, to get hold of lands finally after so many centuries, and to get money to go forward as self-governing bodies to lift their people up. That was the rosy idea back then, great intentions, but here we are again in 2025, heading into 2026, and very few treaties have been resolved. And there have been First Nations that have decided to go the route of litigation versus negotiation. Why has the BC treaty process not succeeded, or was it designed not to succeed?
It's been slow. I don't think it's not successful. If you Google Comox First Nation or Google Kitsum Kalum, you'll find that there are two new treaties that have just been ratified. And, you know, they're about 200 pages long. But the beauty of treaties in BC is that, first of all, private lands are never on the table in treaty negotiations. They are excluded. The only way private lands will become part of treaty settlement lands is if the private owners agree on a willing seller, willing buyer basis to sell those lands to become part of the treaty settlement lands. Treaty settlement lands are actually held by the First Nation in a communal version of fee simple. So that's the first thing. Private land is not at issue in the treaty process. It resolves that problem. And the way it resolves that problem is that outside of the treaty settlement lands, the treaty ensures that Aboriginal title can no longer be asserted or brought to court or claimed against anybody outside of the treaty settlement lands, and probably not even there. So Aboriginal title is not extinguished, it's not surrendered, it's not given up, but it is rendered, how should I say this, unassertable. It can't be used. It's there, but it can't be used. And so what the First Nation agrees to is the rights that are set out in the treaty are all their rights that they can exercise going forward. So the treaties actually solve this Aboriginal title dilemma quite nicely without actually going so far as the old treaties and demanding a surrender. So I think treaties are actually, they're probably the best option we have while we have Section 35 in the Constitution Act. I think that's what the Supreme Court of Canada says when it says negotiate agreements. And I think the EB government probably misread what the court said about negotiating agreements. I think they were saying negotiate treaties, not things like Haida Gwaii. So the treaty process flow. But the other thing I'll say very quickly about it is that there are certain First Nations throughout BC who don't like the treaty process, never have. There are others who do. There are quite a few nations still in the process. But I think the effect of those who don't like the treaty process has been to undermine the process significantly and to call it down and to say, it's bad, it's a bad thing, don't sign up, right? So there's been quite a movement against the treaty process over the years. I think an unwarranted movement, but I understand people, some people think they're getting a better deal from being able to claim Aboriginal title to Kamloops and the territory and everything. And I don't think that's going to be what they get from the Supreme Court of Canada ultimately, but it's leverage for other advantages.
This all happens at a time of UNDRIP, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which was adopted by the NDP government under John Horgan. The NDP has taken further steps to integrate UNDRIP into legislation across government and policies that have shaped their negotiations with First Nations and their litigation as well. This is also a law which is working its way into interesting corners. One small example that I found after the renaming of Trutch Street here in Vancouver to Musqueam View, and it's also got a Musqueam equivalent name that I'm not going to attempt right now. City of Vancouver has refused to provide me documents about the costs, how much is spent on street signs, and also the ceremony to have the renaming and unveiling of the new street signs because of Section 18 in the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act. And that is relating to UNDRIP. It's to protect Indigenous interests. That's just a small example of how deep this is going throughout the BC government. Was the original idea of UNDRIP to take away rights of all citizens in this fashion? Wasn't it to for the reconciliation?
I would ask your listeners to Google the calls to action of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Look at calls 41 through 47 in particular. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission had a mandate to deal with residential school issues. As far as I'm aware, they did not have a mandate to describe for the country the framework for reconciliation that was going to be used going forward in Canada, i.e. UNDRIP. So this whole UNDRIP thing actually goes back to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. BC got on the UNDRIP bandwagon first and was followed by the Trudeau Liberal government federally. And what BC said it was doing in the DRIPA legislation, and people will hear about DRIPA and UNDRIP. DRIPA is the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act. It is a BC statute. What it says is it says UNDRIP provisions will be brought into conformity, or BC laws will be brought into conformity with UNDRIP. So it's important for people to know that at this stage, UNDRIP is not actually the law in BC. It's been designated to be something that BC laws have to be aligned with, and that's an important distinction. So then we have UNDRIP. Now, UNDRIP is a UN declaration. It's not international law. And it has some very interesting things to say about certain subjects that the Supreme Court of Canada has already talked about in its jurisprudence. So I want people to understand, first of all, that Canada has a reconciliation framework already without UNDRIP, called Section 35. And the Supreme Court of Canada has spent years and years and years developing that jurisprudence to try and balance Aboriginal rights and title with the rights of non-Indigenous people. UNDRIP is not a balancing instrument. It is basically a human rights document. The rights are described basically as absolute rights. There's no balancing except for Article 46, which says, well, you can't undo the sovereignty of the state using UNDRIP. Well, I would say big deal. You can do a lot of other things. So I want to give you three examples where UNDRIP, I think, is totally inconsistent with the Canadian reconciliation framework under Section 35. Article 26 of UNDRIP says if you have a traditional territory that you've laid claim to, the entirety of your territory you own, and you own all the resources in it. Section 35 does not say that. Section 35 says Aboriginal title only occurs where you occupied land to a certain standard exclusively as of 1846. So we have the Chilcotin case where Chilcotin won Aboriginal title under Section 35 to about 2.5% of their entire territory. UNDRIP says that entire territory is theirs. That's a conflict from my point of view. Second conflict, Supreme Court of Canada has been crystal clear that there is no constitutional obligation to consult with Indigenous people about the promulgation of legislation in Canada. No obligation. UNDRIP turns that around and says it is actually an obligation and governments have to include Indigenous people in the promulgation of legislation. So what we have in BC now, and I don't know if a lot of people know this, the First Nations Leadership Council is closeted with members of the BC government daily, I think, deciding on legislative policy for the province. So not only are we engaged in consultation, we are co-developing legislation for the rest of British Columbians between the First Nations Leadership Council and the EB government. That's problem number two. Problem number three, people will know about already, which is under Article 32 sub 2 says consent, free, prior and informed consent, FPIC, is always required for any project that might affect a territory as defined in UNDRIP, which means the whole territory. That consent provision is not the case in Canadian law, not. The only place consent is required by the Supreme Court of Canada is in cases where Aboriginal title has been proven, like in Chilcotin, where if the province wants to do something on those lands, it has to ask for consent from the Chilcotin. Well, that makes sense. Those are their lands now. But it's also important to know that if the consent isn't forthcoming, the province has access to an infringement test under Section 35, under which they can theoretically still proceed if they meet certain standards of constitutional behavior. So those are three examples where UNDRIP, in my view, is totally antithetical to the reconciliation framework Canada already has in its constitution. So I ask the question, why are we doing this? And from what I can see on a daily basis, what we've done is we've layered on top of our constitutional obligations all of this other stuff, which I think is now creating uncertainty. It's being done in secret, absolute secrecy, and it's basically making everything totally convoluted. And I think it's creating division. So if somebody asks me, what do you think of DRIP? I would say repeal it.
So what should the public be demanding from their politicians at this crucial time?
Well, my suggestion would be that the public should demand transparency from its provincial government. There's a lot of this that's been going on in total secrecy. Even the Freedom of Information legislation has created the ability for government to withhold any information that might affect Indigenous negotiations. So that means you can't even get access to this information through Freedom of Information. So I would say the secrecy is entirely problematic. And there are all kinds of negotiations going around on around the province where the government says it's negotiating Aboriginal title. Well, if it's doing what it did on Haida, that's truly frightening. But we know nothing about it. We're not told. And so I guess my last word for the public would be, ask them, demand that they come clean as to what is going on.
So thanks again to Jeffrey Moyes, former senior lawyer with the British Columbia government, advised six British Columbia governments on Aboriginal issues, especially land use, joining us on the Breaker.News podcast.
Thank you.
Podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, France reaffirms support for peace in Taiwan Strait. Foreign Ministry thanks Paris for commitment to peace and stability. French Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot highlighted deepening cooperation in energy, AI, and semiconductors. Such fields, he noted, align with France's reindustrialization and strategic autonomy goals. Meanwhile, Fiji's United Nations representative was among Fijian diplomats who visited Taiwan and attracted criticism from China. The Taiwan government said that China has no right to interfere in normal exchanges between sovereign countries. In Kyoto news, Taiwan emergency could be survival-threatening for Japan, says PM Takeuchi. Prime Minister Sane Takeuchi said November 7th that Japan could exercise the right of collective self-defense. Takeuchi took office on October 21st and is known as a pro-Taiwan lawmaker. In ABC News Australia, Chinese-made electric buses on Australian roads spark cybersecurity concerns after Norway flags issue. Norwegian transport operator Ruter published test results that showed bus maker Yutong Group had access to buses' control systems for software updates and diagnostics on the model they tested. Quote, "In theory, this could be exploited to affect the bus," it said, explaining the bus could be remotely turned off. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, police arrest 39 people on outstanding warrants during camping ban enforcement. 40 arrests were made in just 5 days. Within the first year of his administration, Mayor Keith Wilson has opened over 800 nighttime shelter beds, with the goal of opening 1,500 total by December 1st. An opposition councillor said criminalizing homelessness was cruel, expensive, and ineffective. In Spokane, spokesman review, convicted killer gets third strike after latest Spokane assault, sentenced to life in prison. A 55-year-old convicted killer was sentenced Thursday to life in prison without parole after his latest violent Spokane attack marked his third strike. Court documents indicate that Ian C. Irizarry's first strike came in 2003 in Tacoma when Irizarry, who was camping under a bridge, bludgeoned another camper to death. That was 12 years in jail for manslaughter. He was convicted in 2021 and 2024 of assaults, the most recent with a machete. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Secrecy and spin are damaging democracy. And Carney kicks another $100 million into FIFA World Cup 26. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Lighthouse Keepers up and down the Pacific Coast. On November 16, 1860, Fisgard Lighthouse in Colwood became the first permanent lighthouse on Vancouver Island. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar? Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. that's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 16th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 16th of November in 1990, German pop duo Milli Vanilli was stripped of its Grammy Award after it was confirmed that they did not sing on their hit album, Girl, You Know It's True? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com.
Until next week.